Good evening. You're watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. My name is Eric Kirk. I'm with Dave Frank. And Matt Knight is out today. He is not producing. We are self-producing this. So if anything goes wrong, please do not blame him. But we are going to attempt, we're venturing into new territory today. And fortunately, we only have one topic, although we are going to break it up into three subtopics because the topic is huge. And I know we've been talking a lot about the multiple indictments of Donald Trump. I don't know if any more are coming, but I think this is hopefully the last. But this is different from all of the others in that it is a state-based charge rather than federal. It is happening in Georgia. It is very similar to the latest Jack Smith charges. It is primarily racketeering under the state's what's referred to as RICO laws, which is basically accusing Donald Trump and about 18 other co-conspirators of basically organized crime, of conducting a scheme of fraud, intimidation, and other things. And it is very long and elaborate. It is, again, as I have said about the other indictments, I believe every American should read them, even though this pertains to an individual state. The prosecution, the Fulton County District Attorney, has filed these. It is about 90 pages long, but it is actually very well written. As you noted before the show, Dave, it's divided up into acts, almost kind of like a play is written rather than paragraphs. At any rate, it goes into the famous telephone call with the attorney general, the fake elector scheme of the 16 fake electors of Georgia. Three of them have been charged. It's believed that at least some, if not all of the others, are actually going to be witnesses on behalf of the prosecution, so have made immunity deals. We will probably learn more about that. It involves attempts to intimidate or lie to officials in different state programs. It involves the Coffee County breach of security, of the voting process system. It involves a whole lot of stuff. It's hard to even know where to start to describe this, but this is very involved. Unlike Jack Smith, she's not messing around. She has got 18 co-conspirators. A lot of the people who are named as the co-conspirators in the third indictment, the Powell, Giuliani, Eastman, but this one has Mark Meadows, who, interestingly enough, was one of the few people who was actually in Trump's department officially. And in fact, he's actually trying to request that his defense be moved to federal court because he wants to claim immunity because he was acting in an official capacity. That's going to get a little bit complicated. But Mark Meadows is also theorized to have been cooperating with Jack Smith. Possibly. We don't know this, but there's been a lot of speculation about that. And then there are a number of other defendants. I mentioned some of the co-conspirators, but even some kind of bizarre people, including the former publicist for Kanye, who was involved in trying to intimidate one of those two poor women, the African-American women who were harassed by Trump's team and doxxed to the point that they were receiving death threats, and they actually have sued Giuliani and are living in, had to quit their jobs and are living in hiding. We're talking about Ruby Freeman. And the woman's name who was part of this is Trevian Coody. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but I mean, and they combined with other people who were intended to intimidate Freeman. It is just absolutely bizarre some of the things that are being alleged, and we'll get into it. But it is against the law. This is their, of course, claims that they have First Amendment rights to lie, but not in certain contexts you don't have. And you don't have the right to lie to government officials in order to obtain certain types of results. You don't. It just like you don't have the right to lie to obtain a driver's license, or as we know with Hunter Biden, to obtain a gun permit. You know, you don't have the right to lie in order to get election results overturned or get whatever else you want. There is so much here. I don't even know, you know, it's hard to know where to begin. But Dave, I'm going to ask you to tell, give some general thoughts here, and we can, you know, get into the weeds.
Yeah, thank you for that setup. It's important for us, I think, just to, like, we decided we're going to break it down by sort of the court case itself and the legal aspect, and then sort of the cultural reception to it, and then finally, like, what is the impact on national politics? So that's mm-hmm. that's generally how I think we're going to hit it. But yeah, like you said, RICO, Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, that's a federal act from 1970, but other states kind of came up with their own version of it. And I think Georgia's is from around 1980. But in this one, there's 161 acts that kind of spell out, it's almost to a certain extent like a narrative of events and actions by some of the various 19, you know, Trump plus 18 co-conspirators. Through so there's 41 distinct charges, and in each of those acts, it goes through, you know, one of those who is involved. So it sometimes it's Trump, sometimes it's his chief of staff, sometimes it's his attorneys, but other times it's people on the ground in Georgia. So at any stage of the elements, you could get some of these people involved. So Trump is facing, you know, overall, like all the indictments, 91 criminal counts totaling, you know, nearly 600 years in prison. This Georgia piece is, he's facing 71 and a half years in prison. So this is very serious. And one of the reasons that I think it's kind of more serious than you know, the other, you know, certainly than the federal charges, is that because it's a RICO violation, there's sort of lower standards in terms of what you can actually bring into the case as a, like, a mitigating factor. I'm sure you as a lawyer will be able to tell us a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. But the idea here is that as they go through these events, they don't have to prove that what was done is actually what was carried out criminally. But as it's painting the picture of a pattern. And so the specific charges in this pattern, what makes it a RICO violation is that it's not just one crime that was furthered, it's two or more crimes. And in this case, there's actually three crimes involved, at least, that to paint the picture, to fill it in for folks. And like you, I think you said, the call to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find more votes, you know, that's pressuring a public official to act to violate their oath of conduct. He's supposed to run a fair and, you know, legal and legitimate auditable election by the election rules. And there's the allegations here that that's not what was happening, that various players tried to petition him to do more than that, you know, extra legal activities. And also, there's steps around the alternative elector slate strategy. So the documents involved in those that they filed, we've talked about before. So it's not just talking to those people about being false or alternate electors, but they filed documents with the archives. They filed documents with the federal government. They filed documents, you know, so there's document allegations of document crimes there, too. And then finally, the third crime lane here is that, like you said, the Coffee County breach of their voting system, election equipment, which this one I think is damning because, again, allegedly they used false pretense to access what is not public, and they copied it and they made it public, uploaded it to a sort of a private server to share with their allies to look into it and try to find irregularities. This is all extra legal. This is all outside the scope of the election, legitimate election process. So big picture, when Trump and his allies were saying that we want to find the problems, we want to find the errors, we want to find the fraud, we want to find what went against the legitimate election process. In fact, that's what they're being charged with themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I and again, it's going to be really hard to summarize the whole thing, but I've chosen a few highlights that I want to point out. And a lot of the actions that are alleged did not take place in Georgia. But because we're talking about an organized criminal action, they all become relevant because they're telling a story of an organized criminal. It's beyond a conspiracy. Conspiracy is one thing. That's a theory of joint criminal liability. But this is beyond that. This was an actual operation. And one of them goes back before the election. An unindicted co-conspirator individual number one, whose identity is known to the grand jury, it will be obviously somebody with an immunity deal, says that 4 days before the election, Donald Trump was actually planning to declare that there was fraud, election fraud, even before any of this happened. Of course, we all knew about the red mirage and the blue shift. We were talking about it even in the weeks before the election on this show. And so Trump had to know about it, and they were going to use that because there are a lot of people that don't understand the math of it and the reality of it, especially since he was discouraging people from early voting, that this was inevitable, that this was going to happen, but he was planning to make use of it. Trump and Meadows created a memo on how to disrupt Congress on January 6th. So this is interesting because Jack Smith doesn't go into anything about that, about whether or not they were involved in trying to intimidate Pence and the Senate into disrupting and Congress into into anything on January 6th. This brings up that there was specifically a memo as to how they were going to do it. We have not learned exactly what's on that memo, but we'll be fascinated. It will be fascinating to learn that. Meadows tried to interfere with an audit of Georgia ballots. This is going to be a problem for his defense that he wants to say, oh, I was just acting in my capacity under my job with Trump. How does that fit into anything that is official duties of his job? Giuliani is accused of lying to the Georgia Senate about mail ballots and faulty voting machines. You can lie. You have a First Amendment right to lie, but not when certain things, when you're trying to commit fraud, when it comes to certain official capacities and processes. He also lied to members of the Georgia House of Representatives, according to the complaint. We talked about the illegal access of voting data, whether or not it was to find irregularities or to basically take it and frame it as irregularities. We don't know. It didn't really get very far on that. Trump's tweets are cited as evidence of a conspiracy. There's an article out today that they've accessed his direct messages of his tweets. He's screaming about that. Trump and Eastman filed false legal documents. They tried to drag RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel into the conspiracy. It looks like she's not among the defendants. And then they harassed Ruby Freeman. Forged election certification documents. That's very serious. Quoted urging DOJ officials to just say the election was corrupt. That was probably part of the whole installing Clark to be able to make use of the DOJ and all of this. And of course, he lied in the so-called perfect call to Raffensperger. I mean, I can go on. Trump and Eastman and also told Pence that they, according to the complaint, that they were actually violating the law. that they were both in violating the Electoral Count Act. I mean, the hubris of it. There's others, but we're getting towards the end of this particular segment. I just, again, people should read the complaint, but I'm going to let you close this one out, Dean.
Yeah, so I guess because we're talking about the legal aspect of it here, I'll try to be real quick, that I did see a lawyer named Bradley Moss speak about the potential defense, which is, hey, Trump just had free speech here. This is a First Amendment claim. And, you know, that's what he might be, sort of standing behind, and then pushing back on the prosecution that they have the factual burden of making making everybody know or believe that Trump was aware of the knowledge that it was a legitimate election, despite all that evidence to the contrary. But it turns out that what he's saying is that free speech ends where that speech is directed towards people engaged in criminal activity. So people are trying to undermine an election. People are defrauding documents. People are all the things we just talked about. And so, like, the fact that Raffensperger did not have the authority to decertify the election, throw out votes, or declare Trump the winner, that – you know, attempting to influence that that speech is not protected, because you are to a certain extent petitioning, as his lawyer said, petitioning a public official, but to engage in activity that they can't do. And that could be perceived as pressure, undue pressure, which is coercion. And that's a crime if that person did it. So you're trying to make the person commit a crime. And there's a lot of other, elements here. But the idea that Trump told Jeffrey Clark, who was the temporary acting attorney general for a moment, but he was a DOJ lawyer, Trump told him to send a letter to a Georgia official stating that the Justice Department found that there were election irregularities, and they actually had a draft version of that prepared, even though Clark was advised by White House lawyers and Justice Department lawyers that wasn't true. So again, this is a quote from the lawyer. Free speech cannot be used in the furtherance of a criminal conspiracy or to get others to commit a criminal act on your behalf. So you're not free to just tell a Justice Department lawyer to send a letter on behalf of the Justice Department that says something that's fundamentally not true. And so the burden here is that, the RICO statute gives some flexibility and allows the prosecutor to bring up these things that in and of themselves might not rise to a convictable criminal offense. And this is a whole network, lattice work of interoperating parts. And I'll say one last thing. I think we'll end up going up a little tiny bit over in this segment.
Sure.
We'll make up for it later. But I thought this was really important too. The overall indictment is alleging that the conspiracy to reverse Trump's electoral loss, Trump and his advisors were influencing state legislators and communicating with them in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona, and trying to organize fake electors in Wisconsin, Arizona, and other states. So even though the jurisdiction here is only Georgia, the prosecutor has laid it all out and saying, this whole story as it plays out is a textbook, according to the prosecutor, textbook racketeering. It mirrors what the racketeering statutes are set out and designed to rein in and hold people accountable for. And one last thing, this prosecutor is actually very experienced and has done this before, these racketeering cases. I think I heard her say that while she's been there, they've done 11 of these at Fulton County Court, 11 RICO cases. So they know how to make it happen from a logistics perspective.
And let me just really quickly say, on the call to Raffensperger, the media has focused a lot on the 11,000, however many votes, saying, I want you to find him. That could actually be interpreted different ways, possibly. But that and the media has focused on that as the criminal aspect of it. That's not really the criminal aspect of it. The point is that Trump, according to the complaint, told 13 lies to him to try to do that. Everything from 5,000 dead people voted to 200,000 more votes were recorded than the number of people who voted in the and that thousands of dead people voted. The fact that Raffensperger saw through it and knew they were lies is not a defense. The point is that he told lies trying to influence an official to violate the election. And it's not a defense that the lies were outlandish, some of them. Anyway, that's so we'll have a lot more to say about this as everything envelops, but we should move to the next segment. So, Dave, we're talking about the cultural impact of this particular this fourth indictment of Donald Trump, and if you include the civil actions that are taking place, there's probably a certain amount of fatigue on the part of a lot of the public, and there's probably a certain amount of everybody in their particular camps seeing things the way they do. Those people who are dislike or are afraid of Trump or and what he represents see these as justified and basically back the prosecutions. Those who support Trump are seeing these as political or weaponization of prosecutions. What the Republicans, of course, Tuberville, and McCarthy and all the, and some of the others are calling it professional. In fact, some of them are even making threats that they're going to do the same thing when they take power, when the next time there's a Republican president. But I don't know what they believe as opposed to whether or not they're just catering to the MAGA crowd. And then there is that 5 to 10% of people who may be swayed one way or another. How is this affecting? We'll get to the political effects later. But how is what is this effect? Is this having on the country in general on a cultural level?
Yeah, to me, I think this is one of the more interesting pieces of it because we talk so often about the politics and we talk pretty regularly about the, you know, what's in the technically, what's in the indictment. But we are really seeing, the sort of unique ecosystems of information that people reside in. We're seeing a World War I level degree of trench warfare here, where people that I would argue are relatively mainstream and common citizen in the street for the most part, at least on the coasts where we live and where the news is generated, East Coast, West Coast kind of thing, that there are people really sticking to the rule of law, defense of democracy, fighting, pushing back against a coup, statements in support of accountability. So that's like the general tone. But then when people sort of get more like, okay, well, what are we really experiencing? Then they're saying, well, let's just look at the calendar and let's just see, like, big picture, finger to the wind. Is it even possible to have Trump be running for president at all? Because it just seems like if he's got all these court dates, going through, interspersed throughout this next year, which is so important. They're sort of uncertain how to really process, sort of at a cognitive level. And then also, with all these experts out there, expert analysis on the specific charges and giving information about the overall legal process. It's, you know, that again, these are people that are just sort of, like I would argue, are sort of mainstream, just trying to make the best of the situation, like not get too engaged or too involved. But I contrast that with kind of the right-wing media ecosystem, conservative media generally, more generally, and it's an oversimplification, but to a certain extent also the social media realm. That's where we're seeing really, you know, hyperbole on steroids. So Trump makes the best of it. You know, he makes it, puts on a good face, and he says that these claims are the indictments are good for him. And, you know, he's able to, like, sort of inflame supporters, defame the Department of Justice, defame court staff members. And he's also soliciting more donations to a certain extent. You know, maybe the gravy train will run out, but he still is able to really rally the troops to give him money. But what I think, again, not to over, you know, just keep talking here, but like fringe elements of his supporters are actually they are now taking this to a more dangerous level. And I think that's why I wanted to go down this road. It's not like it's anything front and center just yet. But immediately after the indictment and through till today, the inflammatory rhetoric is including things like, for example, the grand jury members were all doxxed. So every single person on the grand jury, their name, their address, family members, where to get in touch with them, where they work in theory, like that's doxing in general, which is putting them at risk of revenge, harm, and violence. And it's not even just like they're being targeted as individuals, but there is a tone, there's a dangerous tone, which is the racism. And so before I dive into that, I'll kind of let you give me a little bit of feedback about the general cultural reception of where we are.
It is kind of a scary thing, because if you have a large number of people believing that somebody who is a former president and who is a leader of a major movement is being unfairly jailed, and I see this online, people are saying, well, we are at a point in history. Tuberville said it, and others have said it, we are now jailing our opposition. Well, those statements are kind of pregnant with admission, because the only way that he can be jailed is if he's found guilty, right? That means a jury has to find him guilty, but they're going to say, well, you know, these juries are in Atlanta or Washington, D.C. The grand jury in Florida for the second indictment was definitely not a typical, that's not a typical, Democratic area. In fact, Jack Smith may have chosen that for that reason. That's why they've got that judge again. So it's a lot of interesting stuff going on in terms of this. But if we have a lot of people believing that and he's actually convicted, that is a scary thing, because imagine if you do believe that, you know, the person you believe is most qualified to run the country, and that he is a movement against corruption, and he goes to jail. That's a dangerous situation. You know, this is and this is kind of separate from a political, you know, we're not talking about how it's going to influence the election. We're talking about what this can do to the country. We've talked about, are we going to have a civil war? I don't know that we're going to have a civil war, but are we going to ever come back together as a country? Again, we talk about how we have two Americas, right? That have very different views of reality. And that is a very dangerous situation for the Republic. And are these things going to change? Is this one in general, can this change anything? Now, this is different. This particular prosecution is different from some of the others, because it outlines some things in detail that even the third prosecution doesn't outline. I mean, it gets into details that are really hard, if they are proven, to deny. I mean, really key details here. If they're all lies, then fine. But what people are going to say is, hey, you shouldn't be sending people to jail for lying, because we should send all politicians to jail for lying, right? But you know, but explaining racketeering and that those lies are not themselves the crime, but only in conjunction with other acts are a crime. That's a subtle thing. And if somebody doesn't want to hear about it, they're not going to hear about it. And you know, the thing about this is there's a lot of comments coming from the left, so to speak, the people who don't like Trump, that Trump is essentially running to stay out of jail. And there's a question as to whether or not that even works for this one, because he can't pardon himself from a state conviction. That's would be a violation of the 10th Amendment. He has no jurisdiction to pardon that. So he can't be jailed during that time. But the conviction could be sitting around waiting for him to leave the presidency. Then does he leave the presidency, right? I mean, then does he want to give up power so that he avoids prison time in Georgia? So that he spends time in prison in Georgia. We are on uncharted territory in this country by far. That we have never experienced anything like this, not with Watergate, not with any other corruption scandal in the history of this country.
Yeah, unprecedented, dangerous, and I think we'll see how it plays out over the coming 15 months, obviously. But we have a situation now where, for example, and it's not all the members of Congress certainly, but there are key allies of former President Trump in the Congress, like for example Representative Jordan, who's out there saying, you know, this is a witch hunt, and you know, when you drain the swamp, the swamp fights back. And saying that, you know, there's not just him, but others are saying that, well, this DA is really just an activist DA, and mm-hmm. they look into raise money to further her political career. So these are all sort of expected kind of dismissive kind of, if you're not going to argue on the merits, like you said, jailing somebody implies that they went through an entire court proceeding and then actually were found guilty by a jury, and then these folks are going to disparage that jury ahead of time. They're disparaging the citizens of Atlanta ahead of time in the Fulton County here by saying like, oh, Fulton County, excuse me, he's not going to get a fair trial here. So this is polarization, but it's not, you know, that to a certain extent that degree of polarization could be expected. But I want to point out this key element here too, which is that everybody around Trump, for the most part, did tell Trump and his inner circle that election interference did not happen. So again, White House lawyers, DOJ lawyers, campaign staff, family members, there's notes, there's emails, there's text. You know, many people had these conversations, and this is all documentable. So you don't know what's in Trump's mind. You don't know what's in, you know, Giuliani's mind or Sidney Powell's mind or any of his inner circle here. But you know what I heard a lawyer say is that you cannot use delusion as a defense. You have to have a basis for your opinion, and all of the factual evidence that's been brought to light so far in these indictments, and we're going to see how it plays out. These are just allegations, but that Trump and his inner circle kept only really confiding in people who said that they could make an argument. That they would make the argument without any proof, make that argument without any proof. So much so that Sidney Powell, she was sanctioned for her some of her filings that she put in front of the courts. And then so again, this is also kind of predictable that we're going to argue, or people in the prosecutor are going to try to make the case that a reasonable person should have known. But I know we're kind of, again, kind of extending our time here, but. There is this racism element that I wanted to circle back to. Now, Fannie Willis, who's the DA in Georgia, she had said that the racist stuff started, a long time ago, leading up to this, because she's been investigating the former president for a couple of years now. So her and her staff are used to it. But once the indictment dropped, President Trump said on Truth Social that he used the word riggers, so mm-hmm. people rigging the election. Which is people are describing, advocates for people that are fearful of violent escalation have flagged this. because you know people are always suspicious of anybody who's like inciting violence, but we're starting to see it. Trump wrote, they never went after those that rigged the election. They only went after those that fought to find the riggers. And then immediately after he put that, social media lit up, like Gab and Patriots.win. Those sites have hosted literally hundreds of posts featuring riggers in the headlines. And so again, it's thinly veiled racism, if not overt.
And they're also accusing her of racism. Her father was a Black Panther member and a public defender, and they're really trying to play that up. Never mind. And the fact that her parents gave her African names. So her first name, Fanny, means prosperous in Swahili. Her middle name, Taifa, means people. And so that's being kind of thrown out. Why doesn't she have an American name, whatever that means, right? You know, and even though he was actually very specific, they're saying, well, you know, you're Black Panther and you hate white people. Her father actually pointed out that he was arrested numerous times in his activism, and it was white attorneys who got out of jail. I said something like, those Caucasian lawyers saw value in him and his peers. They believed in what they were doing, and it is what ultimately led to my father to stop being a college professor, in the movement, and go to law school. So that doesn't indicate racism, right? I mean, no. That's and so it's but you know that she has to that she has to defend herself as not being racist simply because she's Black and has an activist background is unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I'll defer to you to kind of wrap this up, this segment, but basically, just in terms of culturally speaking, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better because the stakes are so high. You mentioned a little bit about the RICO statute and pardoning, the fact that the next president, if they're Republican, they won't be able to pardon if found guilty in Georgia. There's an element that I think people have heard, but it's worth mentioning again. The RICO statute in Georgia, the only way that you can get a pardon is if you've already served the first 5 years of your term. And it's a panel, it's a pardon panel, it's not just the governor. So even if they had an amenable Republican governor who would be willing to pardon, it would still be part of a broader process of a review pardon panel. And again, that's after 5 years in jail. So the stakes are very, very high here. And finally, you know, Governor Brian Kemp came out and said, look, these guys have had 2 years to identify how this election may have been rigged, and nobody has found one shred of evidence yet. So this was a fair election. He's a Republican with conservative bona fides. And so there are Republicans out there that are saying, look, there's just simply no evidence. And at some point, we're going to have to face that reality. The governor of Georgia is one of them. So that's an interesting little twist here in terms of the implications for the, you know, there's no like get out of jail free card on the horizon, which makes the stakes that much higher.
So this brings us to, of course, the political implications, which is what we're called upon to talk about and how this is going to affect the election. Nobody knows, but hot off the press, Fannie Willis is asking for a trial on March 4th. Well, guess what? Super Tuesday is March 5th. If I was a Republican conspiracy theorist, I would maybe think that was planned. I don't know. But the idea is to get this done. She does not want to wait until after the election, definitely. We'll see what the judges down there do. But in terms of the impact of this, I do think that if any of the prosecutions have any chance of actually turning anybody who is currently a Trump supporter or even a Republican who's willing to vote for Trump, kind of the middle of the roaders who say, well, yeah, I agree that Trump is inappropriate, but I'm going to vote for him anyway because Biden is worse. You know, it might be this particular conviction because it outlines in detail. It doesn't hold back. And you can kind of make the argument that even if if Biden is not directly influencing the Department of Justice, there are some people who may not go to extreme conspiracy theories to think that he's doing that, but that there might be sort of unwritten or under between the lines influence there, that people in the DOJ might feel like there's an obligation to go after Trump because of who is the president. And that's harder to make an argument for that for a state person, regardless of what Fannie Willis's politics are and the rest. She is completely independent of Joe Biden and his administration. She is making this decision on her own, unless you have some grand deep state theory of influence. But this one could actually shake some things, but we haven't seen anything in the polls yet. This indictment is still fresh. The only movement in the polls I've seen is in the latest poll, Chris Christie, who is the person who has decided to be the attack dog to go after Trump, is just past DeSantis in a poll. That could have some significance in other ways, but I don't think that is attributable to this particular indictment.
Yeah, and just kind of big picture, 30,000 feet, Biden is really out of the question for now for Trump's sort of schedule and, his fight is within the Republican Party to win the nomination so that on July 15th at the convention, he's got, before July 15th, he's got all the delegates locked up. And like you said, March 5th, I think, is that Super Tuesday. There was talk that maybe he's going to have a significant lead by then with his 40 plus point advantage nationally and in most states. So like you said, that sort of jockeying for number two, those are folks that are waiting to see if Trump somehow gets pushed out of the box beforehand, but that doesn't necessarily seem likely. In other words, he does seem likely to be the front runner. Well, he is the front runner, but he does seem likely to be the candidate even. So that, this is, like you said, uncharted territory. These indictments and the accountability associated with it will actually probably energize the Democratic base for sure, which would affect him once he does go to the general. But in reality, Biden doesn't have competition to a certain extent, and all this Trump activity will kind of buoy his support. Trump himself, he's doing everything he can do to dog whistle and really keep the base, mm-hmm. keep the base motivated, but at the expense of alienating sort of moderates and independents. So somewhere around half of the Republican Party is at risk. A third is really at risk. But so that's the question: is are they going to show up on election day in November? The parties are just so apart, so divided that it doesn't seem like, despite all this legalese, that's really going to impact much. But I would say, in theory, if Trump were sidelined, there is a chance that one of the other GOP candidates could actually get a broader level of support than Trump. So the Republican Party might realize that if they could figure out a way, any of those other candidates might actually open up the anti-Biden lane better for them.
Possibly, except that if they don't have Trump on the ticket, do the MAGA people turn out in the numbers? I mean, that's a big deal. Will they be excited about voting for somebody like, well, maybe DeSantis, but you know, Chris Christie. Well, they wouldn't vote for Chris Christie. I don't think he has a chance. He's pro-choice. You know, but you know, I think, you know, in terms of my prediction as to this impact, it's going to be the same dynamic we've seen. It will strengthen his position within the Republican Party and weaken his position with everybody else. I mean, that's just, you know, the irony here. And if that's the Democratic conspiracy, I mean, I don't think it's going to affect him on Super Tuesday negatively, even if a trial is happening. If anything, it'll rally them and they'll come out for him, right? Because first of all, he won't be convicted by Tuesday. It's going to take, the trial is probably going to go on for weeks. And I'm not even sure a conviction would affect his support among his followers. So, I think it's basically the same thing. People, they see the reality they want to see, at least for now. Now, is it possible that as the story develops and more evidence is made and there are pretrial motions where we learn more about the case, that there are some sane elements of MAGA that are going to say, maybe I have been backing the wrong horse for the past, you know, what is it, 7 years or whatever, 8 years. But I just don't know that there's enough there unless I don't know what Trump would have to do to lose that support. I mean, I just don't know. It is absolutely baffling, from a point of view, what people are willing to believe. And it makes me wonder, well, maybe I'm just out of it. You know, maybe MAGA people are right about me. Maybe I'm completely missing the obvious here. I mean, I try to explore that as if it's a possibility, but no, you look at this, you read these charges, and he did these things. We saw it in real time. The right. phone, the lies that he said that are listed, the 13 lies to Raffensperger, we heard them. We've heard the recording of the conversation. He doesn't even deny. He doesn't say that the phone call was altered. And we know that these things didn't happen, that he was trying to tell Raffensperger was happening. So, I just don't see how this is going to change anything. If I was a Republican conspiracy theorist who was not a Trump supporter, I would say that these prosecutions are a conspiracy to make sure that Trump is the candidate to make sure that they lose in November. I mean, you know, that's I mean, almost any of the other candidates, with a few of the exceptions, I think, I actually think at this point DeSantis couldn't beat Biden unless he completely did a makeover by next November. Most of those other candidates, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, could probably have a much better chance of defeating Biden, but they're not going to win.
So I know we just have a couple minutes left and probably less. We have just a minute, so I'll try to just do 30 seconds here and then let you give your final thought. What's interesting is that the trials are all going to be going on concurrently, both Trump, the set of four indictments against Trump, but also this in Georgia, this case with the 19 defendants, they're all going to be tried concurrently, even maybe not in the same courtroom at the same time, because some of their lawyers might petition and say, look, my guy's not doing, or my client is not going to do 5 years for this. What do you need? And so they're going to petition to have their own potentially. And then that will lead to some degree of, you know, some plea deal, some agreement. And so you'll see some of these 18 start, I believe, anyway, of course, who knows, future event, but start to like beef up the case for the prosecutor a little bit. And then it might, you know, this is also the other element of this is, federal courts trials are not televised. State trials are. So yes. This is going to be a melodrama like OJ on steroids. And it's really going to, you know, it's going to reveal some of the schisms and uncertainties of our whole civic discourse. And I think that there's some wild cards yet to be played that will really shake up how we imagine what would happen, even with a conviction.
We haven't had a OJ car chase scene yet, but yeah, it's anyway, I mean, there's only so much more to say about it. I just don't think that this is going to change the current dynamics anytime soon. It may, but you're right about the televising of it. And and the big question will be, does Donald Trump testify? You know, he took the fifth a million times in the depositions. But again, you know, we've already had a jury find that Donald Trump forced his fingers into a woman's vagina. They've already found that in order to find that he defamed a woman, and that didn't faze anybody. So it's just, anyways, we'll be discussing this in the coming weeks.
Eeny, meeny, chilly, beeny, the spirits are about to speak.
Are they friendly spirits?
Friendly? Just listen.
All right, that takes us to predictions. What do you got, Dave?
So I want to talk about the Republican debate that's coming up in a week.
I've got that too. All right.
Okay. So, you know, Trump is basically saying that he's not going to sign this loyalty pledge. But I think there's a little bit of wiggle room. The RNC chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, one of the things that she said is that it's the beat Biden pledge we're asking him to sign. That's a quote. Quote, and what we're seeing, and the debate committee has met for over 2 years, people from Alaska to Illinois to Tennessee, is if you're going to stand on the RNC debate stage, you should be able to support the nominee and beat Biden. One last quote here. Everybody has to sign the beat Biden pledge. Everybody. It's across the board. The rules aren't changing. We've been very vocal with them. So that with that in mind, my prediction is that they're going to craft some document that says, do you agree to beat Biden? They're going to find a way because their brand needs Trump out there. They need it to be a circus. I really think he wants to be out there. I think they're, you know, and we'll know in a week, is he or isn't he? I think they're going to find a way to make it happen.
Trump actually refused to make that pledge last time around. He refused to say that he would support Ted Cruz at a certain point. So it's nothing new for him. But my prediction is it doesn't matter what they craft. He doesn't want to be in this debate. He does not want to face off against Chris Christie. My prediction is he does not show up at this debate. Maybe a later debate, but he does not show up at this debate. We'll find out later, but he really doesn't have to. He's got everything to lose, not a whole lot to gain at this point, unless pure ego forces him to show up. But I think at this point, his refusal to sign is just basically saying, no, don't bother me. I'm going to be the nominee. I don't need to bother with the rest of you.
Cover for everybody. We'll know in a week.
All right. Well, until then, stay informed and stay engaged.